Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode.
This week, we are traveling back to 1973 and 1974 to watch The Three Musketeers, Four Musketeers, directed by Richard Lester. Based on the book by Alexander Dumas, screenplay by George MacDonald Fraser, starring Michael York, Oliver Reed, Richard Chamberlain, Frank Finlay, Raquel Welch, Christopher Lee, Faye Dunaway, and Charlton Heston. So, Dad, why did you pick these two films?
Well, I enjoyed these films when I was younger, and I really enjoy the swashbuckler-style film. This is one of the first instances where I watched a swashbuckler that wasn't, like, highly stylized and highly choreographed. It was more about setting it in a real time in this real place. And it kind of like popped out in my memory, like, oh, you can have these type of movies and have them grounded. And later on, it just was 73. And as you start getting through the 80s and 90s, you start seeing, especially towards the late 90s, when they start doing adventure films and midi, you know, like War of the Rings by 2000, they're really worried. They're really focused on setting these movies with a grounded reality. And I feel like some of these films in the early 70s that started sprinkling in that reality into that led to those. So I thought it would be fun to talk about that. It's more, like I said, more realistic than previous adaptations to the book. It's also a lighter adaptation because they added more humor to it. And they also used, if you watch the film, that you can tell that they were really influenced by the art that came out of Northern Europe, the Netherlands, and England at the time to kind of use it as like a way of framing shots and framing references and costuming and things like that. So it was really kind of, it had a more realistic setting to it. So I really enjoyed it and I want to talk about it. It's also my favorite adaptation I have seen of The Three Musketeers. I didn't know this. I thought I knew of all the adaptations, but there's like 26 film adaptations and counting. And it's not counting the animated versions or the versions that were based on it that were like, you know, The Three Musketeers set in space or something like that. Like there was like a Western version made in 1930s. There were the Musketeers that were like these Western heroes that were going through the West. So like not counting movies like that, but this is like my favorite one I've seen, including all the new ones. They still is my top choice. So did you like the films?
No, I'm just kidding. I did enjoy the films. As you know, and maybe I've mentioned before on this podcast, I used to be a fencer. I'm still really into fencing. I just no longer do the sport. And when I was doing fencing with my fencing master, he was also really into movies as well, which was really awesome because he had this like list of 100 most realistic fights in movies. And sometimes when it comes to sword fighting and some, you know, he put, you know, Seven Samurai on there and things like that. But one of the movies that was on here was the three/four Musketeers. And so I had never seen it, but I knew that it was supposed to be like really good fencing and really good sword fighting ability, which is something that they're known for. Not the real Musketeers, but the book and the movie adaptations is their sword fighting ability. And so I was when you said, hey, I want to watch this movie, I was like, oh, definitely, I'm going to watch this movie. And I watched their sword fighting and I analyzed their sword fighting, and it was actually a pretty fun experience. It definitely brought me back to the sport, you know, me going, I want to go back, you know?
Yeah. And I think one of the things too, that they did in this film, is there's different styles. You could see it different fighters or different swordsmen had different styles. They weren't all the same style. Like you go back and you watch the movies from the 30s and 40s, even though they're highly choreographed and they're really fun to watch, you can see that they're both have the same fighting style. And so it's like, and it's a lot more stylized choreography. And they would fight for like 15, 20 minutes and never get tired. And there was the obstacles weren't that big of a deal. If they were in a room with tables and stuff, they would somehow magically be able to fight their way through all the tables and not get stopped or have issues. And this movie really had a sense of place when it came to the sword fights. Like if they were fighting in a stable or they were fighting in a courtyard and there was hanging laundry, that all came to bear in the sword fight. It was like they either used it to help distract the people that they were fighting, or it became an obstacle and they had to fight around it, that kind of stuff. So I think that made it much more interesting. It made it more, like I said earlier, set in place. And you can tell that they were in a real, quote unquote, place in the movie, and they treated it that way. The film was shot in Spain, so it was very interesting how they dressed the set so it felt like Paris in the 1700s, no, 1600s. It felt like Paris. And so you just basically got to see the way that they made the streets look lived in, the way they made the buildings look lived in, even the castle where the king was still looked lived in. It was very, as much nicer than all the other places, but it still looked lived in and used. So that's why they led that into the sword fights as well.
Mm-hmm. Because as you know, everybody's a little bit different. And so they're not all going to have this, like, you attack, then I defend, and then I attack and you defend thing. There are fencers / people who fight who are more aggressive and people who are on the defense and things like that. And you could definitely tell that with the fighting. I also thought it was really interesting that D'Artagnan becomes a little bit more confident with his fighting. At the beginning, he's being taught by his dad and he's like making, you know, bonehead mistakes like you do when you're not, you know, fully prepared or fully, you know, a master of sword fighting. And throughout these two films, he becomes a little cocky and a little like, I'm cooler than you with his sword fighting, which I thought was also a very interesting technique too to bring to the film.
Yeah, and they also use the different techniques of dueling. Like you'd have, there's like different people that would definitely, different characters that were repeating that would use the dueling dagger as well as the...
I saw that a lot with the Christopher Lee character, which is...
Comte de Rochefort. We would say Roquefort in America, like the cheese, but in the movie and in the book, they keep pronouncing it Rochefort. And so that's what I'm trying to say, is the Comte de Rochefort, which is not even that close. So
we see this dueling style with Christopher Lee's character.
And the Cardinal Guards tend to have it more than the Musketeers. And one of the reasons why is traditionally in actual history with the Musketeers. The Musketeers were more like elite troops than they were. And the name comes from what they actually did. They were all given muskets and they were attacking troops and they would be used for siege warfare by the king. They'd also be the king's personal guard, which is why they had the swords. But swords were mostly for like dueling and after they used up their muskets in the battle. So you can go watch documentaries about the Musketeers and how they really operated. In the book, though, since the book is more of a personal story, like the duels and stuff like that, that's why there's so much sword fights, which at that time, duels were very common. Even though they were, quote unquote, illegal by the king, they were still happening. And that's why everybody had their swords and they were dueling.
There's this definite historical fiction aspect when it comes to Musketeer movies, because we're so ingrained with the swashbuckling sword fighting D'Artagnan version of Musketeers that we forget that their main choice of weaponry was not sword fighting. It was muskets, because they are called the Musketeers. And we were actually watching a...
And they were muskets were expensive. So that's also at that time to produce, because they were all handmade. So that's why when you became a king's musketeer, it was an elite. You were an elite soldier at that point.
Yes. And we were watching this documentary about the Musketeers and the real people who inspired this story. And the lady who was like, it was so funny. She was like, yeah, people forget that they got their names from muskets and not sword fighting. They're not called Swordeteers. And I thought that was just so funny.
Yeah, she was a little over the top. But I think the thing that people tend to forget, there was a huge shift in warfare at that time because of muskets and cannons and stuff like that. Armor was fading away. You still would see every now and then people wearing breastplates for protection from bullets, but most of the armor was gone by then, and any armor was more ceremonial and things like that. But
But also, it changed the warfare because a lot of people who were royalty or nobility were dying as well because of the fact that
anybody can get shot.
Yeah, anybody can get shot. With sword fighting, well, it was very close and one-on-one, but it was also taught to only certain people, like the rules and like how to defend yourself and like how to become a great sword master. It was only taught to a few selected people who were nobility and royalty. So if they ever got on the battlefield, which is, you know, less likely than you or I, but because we're not noble, but they had a certain skills to defend themselves so they wouldn't die as easily. But because of the muskets and the cannon, especially since a lot of the people who used cannons and used muskets didn't aim because of the fact that they thought if somebody died from this bullet, it's God's will. If I was aiming, it's murder. And so you can aim the cannon wherever you want, and that could be the king or his duke or his bishop.
Well, I think the thing too is that if you look at the way battles were fought with knights and armies in the past, in the previous wars up until that point, you also had the nobles and the very, very important people in back as reserves and would only commit if they needed to, or if the battle was already swinging in their favor, that's when they would commit a lot of the time. There still would be nobles acting as generals out on the thing, and that's why you'd get certain people killed in certain battles. But a lot of the reserves, the really, like the king or the really powerful people, were in the back. And when you're shooting arrows and you're using swords, it's hard to hit people back there like that. When you're shooting cannons and bullets, errant bullets and errant cannon fire can go anywhere, and so that's another thing that happened. There wasn't a safe spot anymore on a battlefield. And so they had to rethink how they were doing it. So yes, there was and because they weren't aiming either, who knows where that stuff was going. But yeah, mostly musketeers were used in the siege warfare, and they were used as the king's personal guard. They were together and then disbanded and brought back a couple times depending on the king. So their history is a little spotty too. So you have to, it's a fun history to read, but it's not like from the 1400s on through like the 1900s, there's the musketeers. They come and go. So if you read it, you can, you know, it's very interesting. It's who's in power at the time, which king really liked them and wanted to use them, which cardinal was in charge at the time. In this movie, Cardinal Richelieu is the bad guy. In this story, Cardinal Richelieu is the bad guy. But in the two sequel books that he wrote, there was a different cardinal, and that cardinal was a little bit more of a gray area, because D'Artagnan actually eventually in one of the sequels goes and works for the cardinal, and that splits up the four musketeers. But that's a whole other book.
So, well, also we should probably mention that the four musketeers, I'm including D'Artagnan in that we see in this book and in this movie, are actual real, based on real people.
There was an actual D'Artagnan. and he wrote a memoir. It was what I would constitute as an autobiography. In that memoir, he mentions the three, Athos, Porthos, and Aramis. And everybody's pretty sure that those are code names, of course, for people who really existed. There are people who think they know who those people are. They were all lesser. Basically, a lot of the musketeers were lesser nobility, and they were like the younger brother. Like D'Artagnan was the youngest brother of a lesser noble family from Gascony. And so that's why he goes become a musketeer to make his way in the world. And so that's, and then there's no proof that any of them met each other and knew each other, because in the book, they come in at different, in the memoir, they come in at different times. Historians have pointed out that there's factual inaccuracies in the memoir. So who knows? Maybe it's probably him telling more stories than truth. And so, as I like to say, this is a story that's based on kind of a true story that's based, you know, so it's like, yeah, there was a D'Artagnan and he was a musketeer.
Well, also Alexandre Dumas' characterization of the musketeers is a little bit different than what they were in real life. They weren't like these solo adventurers. They were, like we were describing, like troops.
Like soldiers.
So Alexandre Dumas' characterization of the musketeers is a little bit off as well.
Well, he was also, you have to understand, at that time when he's writing, and there's different revolutions that happen. In fact, there's a couple that happened during his lifetime after he wrote this story. And so he was writing the story as, hey, remember in the good old days when we used to have these adventures and our country was like really cool and there wasn't a revolution every 30 seconds and we didn't go from empire to republic back to royal, to a royal family, back to an empire. And then, you know, like all these things were switching back and forth. So his stories, when he wrote them, were really trying to tap into that nostalgic vein. So they were much more that adventure style. He actually is credited with starting that true adventure style where you mix romance and historical fiction to make a romantic historical adventure story. Mm-hmm. And before that, there was historical fiction and there were romances, but they weren't really mixed. So he's given a lot of credit for that.
Yeah. And before somebody points out that he may not have, you know, he didn't start out with the idea of the Three Musketeers because the book was given to him by a friend and he rewrote it. And then the sequels were written under him in a workshop format. Just know that that was very common at that time. It's very similar to like fashion designers now, you know, it's not the same fashion designer as it was 60 years ago under the Coco Chanel label, but it's a Coco Chanel coat.
Yeah. Or painters, the Renaissance painters that would start and finish paintings, but there was a lot of people that were working on them in between and then they would sign off on them.
It's more of like an awesomeness guarantee. Like,
yeah.
What's it called?
Well, he would, basically what he would do is he'd have a couple people. He had one person in particular, but he had a couple people. What they would do is they would find stories or he would pitch a story and they would write an outline and they would go do all the work and outline the story and build the story. And then he would come back behind and flesh it all out and write it. So he was really involved in the writing process of it, but there was people that were assisting him on finding the stories or, because as you know, some of the stories were based on historical events that he wrote, or they would have these like story ideas. So it's very similar to, I guess would be very similar to some aspects of how the entertainment industry works now, where there might be a writer that starts the process, a couple writers that come in and work on it. And then there's a writer at the end that might get all the credit or who knows?
Well, yeah, because we get the story. We got the story by so-and-so, but so-and-so did not write it.
Yeah. And there was an actual lawsuit towards the end of his life where one of the people that did this came out and said, no, you should give me half credit. And even the court at that time said, no, you wrote the outline, so you'll get 25% of the royalties because you did all this work. But no, the name, the you're not going to get your name added to the stories. Because if they, and also the court at that time realized if they did that, how many writers they would have to go back to and change that.
So you told me this interesting fact about this movie that sounds totally fake, but is actually real. Uh-huh. That this movie, this particular
version
was this particular version of Three Musketeers, Four Musketeers was actually pitched by or for the Beatles.
Yes, they wanted the Beatles to play the Four Musketeers. I don't know if I ever got far enough along where they assigned which Musketeer was which Beatle. There probably was maybe some parts of that in the pitch meeting, but they did not move very far into the process.
Well, they must have moved kind of far into the process because...
Well, no, they did in the sense that they were all interested, or somebody in the Beatles camp was interested, because they got a couple meetings and stuff like that, but they didn't really move that much farther in the process, because you have to remember this is 68 and the Beatles at this time are coming into a different phase and starting a different phase of their career. So,
well, the reason why I said they must have gotten a little bit far into the process is because they brought Richard Lester, the director of this film, because he directed A Hard Day's Night and Help, the movies that also, as you guys know, are Beatles movies.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that got him in the door, and it brought Richard Lester on for this. The thing is that the Beatles component is kind of exciting. It's also like when the Beatles were pitched to do Lord of the Rings, or was that their own pitch?
They wanted to do Lord of the Rings, like, and they had everybody set up, and it was one of them was going to be Frodo, one of them was going to be Aragorn, one of them was going to be Gandalf, and one of them was going to be Gollum, and which I was like, that's a weird assortment of characters. Why can't you all just be the hobbits? Wouldn't it be perfect if the Beatles were the hobbits? But that didn't go through because, fun fact, J.R.R. Tolkien does not like Beatles music.
This was a follow-up to that, I believe. And because they brought Richard Lester on, Richard Lester at that time was trying to make a movie adaptation of the Flashman novels written by George MacDonald Fraser. And the Flashman character novels were historical fiction. They were set in colonial England. So like when England is going around the world creating their empire, there's this character called Flashman, and he ends up working his way up all through misadventure. He's kind of a cad. He's kind of a coward too. So he'll do things not to get killed, and it ends up becoming he's a hero. So their books have a really funny sense of humor about them, about this character. It's kind of taking the heroic character that in historical fiction and turning it on its head. And Richard Lester, they're having trouble getting that movie made, brought in George MacDonald Fraser to write the screenplay for The Three Musketeers, because he thought that would be great sense of humor for this movie. That was the type of tone he was looking for. So that's why this movie has a lot more humor in it, and certain characters are played a little bit differently than they normally are. Like D'Artagnan isn't the young hero all the time. He's kind of not that smart. Mm-hmm. He kind of makes dumb mistakes. His heart goes from "I love you" to one woman, and then like literally within 5 minutes, his heart's going "I love you" to another woman. There's a Flashman-esque component to this interpretation of D'Artagnan, which I enjoy too, because so many times D'Artagnan is so boring because he's so earnest.
I'm D'Artagnan. I will sword fight you now.
Yeah, and he has no personality. In this version, he has a lot of personality. It's not maybe the personality you want your hero to have, but it's a lot more fun to see his growth coming from kind of that rural rube who doesn't really understand everything to the end of the four musketeers to having been involved in much more worldly. And in the books, he becomes even more worldly past the four musketeers, because you have 20 years after, which is the sequel, the second book, and then you have 10 years later, which is the third and last book, which has been, parts of that book have been adapted into other movies and stuff. And other stories, that's where the story of the Iron Mask, the man in the Iron Mask comes from. And at that point, in that story, people are kind of shocked, because at that point, the Musketeers are fractured and they're on opposing sides to get things, and they all don't make it out of the book. And yeah, and so, but D'Artagnan is much more political in that book. So you kind of see the growth of this character. And they did end up making a sequel to this movie back in the late 80s called The Return of the Musketeers, and they brought everybody back. It's not very good. And they kind of changed the story. It does have really some really fun sword fights, but if you want to watch it, again, it's called Return of the Musketeers, and it's directed by Richard Lester, and they brought everybody back to play the four musketeers. The only difference is that some of the characters by this time have moved on, passed away, so you don't see all the characters from the Three Musketeers, Four Musketeers. I don't mean the actors passed away at that time. I mean the in the storyline. So
you called it a sequel, but we watched two movies, so wouldn't it be a threequel or a third movie of the installment?
Well, I kind of, yeah. So that's one of the things. This film was actually shot as one film. It was actually shot to be a 3-hour film with an intermission, kind of like when we watched Cleopatra, where there's like the long epic film. And when they were editing it, they realized they had so much story and footage that they could actually make two movies. So they made two movies. They put out in 1973, they put out The Three Musketeers, and it ended with D'Artagnan being accepted into the Musketeers. And then in 74, they put it out as the last half of it as the Four Musketeers. The first movie, The Three Musketeers, and it had its own subtitle, which is kind of gone by the wayside, but it was The Three Musketeers, The Queen's Diamonds, The Four Musketeers, Miladies of Revenge. And most of that stuff went away in the marketing, and it was just known as The Three Musketeers and The Four Musketeers. You do see it pop up. I think even in the title card for the Four Musketeers, it actually has it down in parentheses or something like that. And so, but most people know the films as The Three Musketeers and The Four Musketeers. It caused a big issue with the cast and the crew, and because they were literally told at the premiere of The Three Musketeers, oh, by the way, the second half of the movie is going to be released next year as The Four Musketeers. And a lot of the cast was upset and the crew was upset because they were paid to do one movie. Mm. And so they were just, what happened is they created the Salkin rule, which the producers, the Salkin, there's actually this rule now. It's in contracts now that when you film one movie, you're not allowed to break it into multiple movies unless you renegotiate or you tell people before, like way before the release of the film. So they can basically ask for more money because you're going to make more money because you're making two movies.
Yeah.
Charlton Heston was the only one that wasn't upset. And he just went, oh, it makes sense. You're going to make two movies for the price of one. Okay. But he ended up getting some extra money for it too. So
I also think that this movie is really interesting to watch because a lot of people in this cast are people that we have seen before.
Well, I think the thing is that in the first movie, people kind of go like Faye Dunaway and Christopher Lee's character. They're introduced and they're bad people. They're bad guys, but they don't do a whole lot in the first movie. They're kind of there and they kind of cause some problems. And then the second movie is when they really come to bear and they're really the main villains. They have to kick some of the main villains they have to get over. And I think that's the thing that you read some of the reviews in 1973, oh, like Faye Dunaway is hardly ever used in this movie. Christopher Lee shows up and then disappears. And it's like, because if you look at the movies as a structure of being one movie, it totally makes sense. You always introduce characters that are going to come back and get you in the third act. In the first act, you can't introduce them in the third act. So they're all being introduced in the first half of The Three Musketeers. And then later on in The Four Musketeers, they become major, major players and villains. So it makes structural sense if you watch two of them back to back, it's like we did.
Yes. I thought this movie was cheesy with the comedy. I really enjoyed it because it was cheesy.
So the comedy didn't work for you?
No, the comedy worked for me. It did work for me, but you can't deny that the comedy was cheesy.
Yeah, I can. I thought the comedy was more, it was light and funny than it was. And I also thought it wasn't like there, some movies, you see some versions of this, you see it make a parody of.
Yeah, it wasn't like Men in Tights, where it was too comedic that the story gets bombarded and you don't really understand the story anymore. But I liked the first movie because it definitely had like a lighter feel than the second movie. Because the second movie, all the things that happened in the second movie. And those are very hard topics, even with comedy, you know? Because you're talking about a religious war, a war about religions, which was teased/kind of seen in the first movie.
Yeah.
With like the Duke of Buckingham and who's from England and everybody is from France and he's a Protestant and they're Catholic and Roman Catholic. And so it's like history dictates that that's not a really good combination. And we see that throughout the first movie, but we definitely see like the fallout during the second film.
Well, yeah, it's talked about the Huguenots or the French Protestant believers or rebels.
And there's like,
it's mentioned in the first one that they're rebelling. And that's why in the first one, they're concerned that Buckingham is going to make a move and support the rebels. And in the second movie that comes to fruition.
Yes. And they make like Monty Python style jokes about religious wars and things like that, which I also thought was really fun.
I wouldn't call them Monty Python because they weren't like absurd and they tied into the movie. They're more, but I also understand why you would say that because that's very British style humor. Mm-hmm. So, but they do tie into the film and the observations about religious wars being not making much sense when you actually get down to it. And by the Musketeers obviously makes it a heavy subject lighter.
Yes. And I did really enjoy the comedy. I think one of the things that makes me think that it was cheesy is that they both had dry sense of humor in the dialogue, but they also had slapstick. And for me, I always read slapstick as cheesy.
Yeah, but the slapstick comedy, I think, was worked in okay into the film. Sometimes it was a little jarring, but it was okay. I think the thing, too, that is that most of it was action in the sword fights that things wouldn't work right. Like you would think the sword fight was going to go in a different direction. And then the comedy, the slapstickiness that you are bringing up was worked into the sword fight to make like these things happen. You know, somebody decides to hit you on the back of the head and you pass out. And so there is no sword fight.
Yeah.
So it's like you getting ready for the sword fight, and it's almost like the scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark where there's this big swordsman that shows up, and you think, oh, this is going to be a huge fight, and then all of a sudden they pull out the gun and shoot him, and it's over, and it's funny, and we play for it for laughs. That's also in this movie. I think it's also one of the things that I like about this movie is that it's funny and light in places, but it's not a parody. I've seen some of the more modern versions where their humor is on the verge of being a parody of the story. They're making a parody of the heroes. They're making a parody of Athos, Porthos, and Aramis to the point where it's like these aren't even the same characters anymore. I think the 1993 version from Disney's probably the low mark on all these. I mean, the one that was made with Logan Lerman is pretty bad.
Well, I actually haven't seen the 2011 Logan Lerman one. I've only seen clips from it, and the clips that I have seen have definitely been like swashbuckling cliches.
Well, I think the thing is that it turns into this weird modern action film halfway through. And, well, not really halfway through. It has the mentality of a modern action film, which you can make it a much more modern take on it. There was a 2001 movie called The Musketeer, directed by Peter Himes. They brought in a stunt choreographer from Hong Kong that updated a lot of the sword fights and a lot of the action scenes to make it better. The movie doesn't really work, But like I'm saying, you can, the movie doesn't really work on a story level, but the action sequences were updated fairly interestingly. And you can do that kind of stuff, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. When the action is not good in a movie / a story that is action based, it does take you out of the story.
Yeah. I think that's the thing too, is that I like the fact that the longer that the sword fights in this film went on, the more they struggled, the more people,
they were actually like fighting.
Yeah. And they got sweaty. They got, you know, they were laboring. Their breath was like, they were trying to catch their breath. They would pause. The longer the sword fight went on, the sloppier their fighting got. Mm-hmm. And some of the, it's funny because some of the reviews in 1973 were like, it's not as crisp and it's not as choreographed, or it doesn't feel as spontaneous or as other sword fight from the 30s and 40s. And it's like, yeah, because that's not the style of fighting that they're doing. And a lot of these reviewers at that time in the 73 had grown up on those films. So that's what they were used to. And so as this more realistic sword fighting was coming in, they didn't understand that was a purposeful choice.
Yeah. We have this like noble idea of what fencing and sword fighting is about, you know, when I say fence, like I used to do fencing, a lot of the people who would like say, oh, you mean like from Princess Bride? And that's a real, like, that fight is fun, but it's, they're not sweating, they're not laboring. You know, it's what we were discussing in the beginning. It's like, I'll attack you, you'll defend, then you'll attack me, and then I'll defend. And it's like a dance more than a fight. But when you actually are sword fighting, you are getting hit, which hurts. You know, you even have protective gear, but it hurts. You're trying to attack somebody while they're attacking you, so you have to do quick changes and things like that. And it's a back and forth thing with a lot of cardio. And if anybody who is a runner knows that cardio sucks. Without the realistic sweat and, I don't want to say bumbliness, but the uncrispness of a fight adds a little bit more realistic and a more historical backdrop, which we were talking about earlier in this podcast.
Yeah, and this film, I mean, the guy who did the choreography for this film was William Hobbs, who is famous throughout Hollywood history for being a choreographer for sword fights.
And yes, and the stuntman. And if you look at his career, a lot of the movies that he has done have been based or are adaptations of The Three Musketeers.
Well, or, I mean, he got to finally, Richard Lester, because of these movies finally got to make the Flashman movie adaptation he wanted to, called The Royal Flash. He wanted to make the whole series, but it only did okay, so he wasn't allowed to really go much more into that. But like, he did some of my favorite films too, like Robin and Marion. And he also did The Duelist, which is another movie that's really great about dueling and sword fighting. And he did Excalibur, Lady Hawk. You can argue about the costumes in Lady Hawk and the weird armor that they wear, but the sword fighting was actually pretty good. And, you know, Willow, and then he Shakespeare in Love. These are all movies he did throughout his career. There's plenty. There's many, many more. And the last thing he finished off before he passed away in 2018 is Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. So this is a guy who really, from the 60s all the way through 2010s, really was working with sword fighting. And people he's trained have gone on to become sword choreographers. Also, if you notice on my name, all those films, those are films, even if they're in a fantastical world, the sword fighting tends to be a little bit more realistic, tends to be on the more realistic side. So I think that's one of the things that was known for.
So why do you think that there are so many Musketeer films? To me, this movie is kind of like Little Women, where every generation has to make their own version. Why do you think that?
I don't know, and it's funny too, because it's not just America.
There's even TV shows of Musketeers.
Yeah, there's even TV shows, and there's movies and TV shows and animated movies that are based on the concept of the Three Musketeers, and so there's that too. There's like the concept of it kind of gets pulled into a lot of movies too. And I think that's because it's an origin story, which origin stories are really fun to make because you get to create the origin of D'Artagnan. You get to create that, as we have realized with Marvel and DC, the best movies usually are the origin story ones, and afterwards you're kind of going, I don't know what to do. And so you have a mixed bag there sometimes. And it's also because it's a young person going into society, you can reinterpret it as what that society he's going into is. You can reinterpret, like 1973, this one, he's going into society that's really has a lot of conspiracies and the government isn't trustworthy, both sides, the king and the cardinal, even though don't have their people's best interest in mind. It's all about maintaining power. Well, you just came out of the 60s. What do you think their commentary on government's going to be like in this movie? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Governments have to be trusted. And well,
this movie came out in 1973, and we all know what happened in 1972.
Yeah. So it's just...
For our non-American listeners, Watergate happened in 1972, which is not a fun thing that happened in America.
So it's just one of those things where I think that's why it's brought in and everybody wants to make it their generational version of it. I think the sad thing is each version up until this version was really defined. You could point that generation and go, oh, that's the musical version made in the 50s or late 40s, early 50s when musicals were really big. And in the 30s, it was when adventure films were really big and it was more adventure-like. And, you know what I'm saying? As you point to different generations and different eras that they're made, you can go, oh, this, yeah, it's the not only the points to that generation, but points to the style of film that was popular at that point. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the last 20 some odd years, every version I've seen tries to make it some gritty,
Pirates of the Caribbean-esque.
No, I think Pirates of the Caribbean is actually a better Three Musketeer movie than the actual Three Musketeer movies that have been coming out. Because, honestly, not talking about the sequels of Pirates of the Caribbean, I'm talking about the first one. Honestly, that's what the whole thing about the Three Musketeers is to be at this adventure. And, like I said, the 2011 one was this weird action film that became so unbelievable that it's like, oh my God.
It had a great cast behind it.
It had a really good cast and it should have been fun, but
they were so behind it that they made a Comic-Con Hall H thing about it.
Yeah. And I think everybody thought this was going to be the next best thing. I think people thought they were going to be able to make a series out of these and like follow the books or something, but they blew the story out of the water. They didn't follow any of the book really. Other than the fact that there's four musketeers by the end, or three musketeers. And
because the movie starts with them trying to steal Da Vinci's blueprints for something. That was like a thing that I watched on YouTube.
Yeah, it's the flying machine. And they end up bringing a flying machine into this thing. It's the stupidest. I'm sorry. It's like you watch this and you start rolling up. It's 2.5 hours I won't get back in my life. And then I really want to send a bill to the filmmakers for how much I make per hour from the film to pay me for watching that film.
Hey, that movie allowed me to be in the same room as Logan Lerman at Comic-Con. So I'm okay with it being crappy because I got to talk to a hot boy when I was 11.
I know you got to sit there and talk to him and ask him a question. And I thought that was great. I think the thing that makes me so annoyed with that film is that there was obviously a big budget.
Yeah.
There was obviously the cast was behind it, but they gave it A to the director who did the Resident Evil movies.
Also Pompeii, which is another movie that I don't particularly like with Kit
Harrington.
Harrington. I almost said Kit Ridge, but that's American Girl Doll. But that movie also is it's the same director, and that movie is kind of also this kind of like mismatched of historical weirdness.
right now, if a director ended up making this movie and literally made a straight adaptation to this film and made it really fun and enjoyable and just had a blast making it, because the last 20 years have had so many bad versions of this, people would go, oh my God, what a refreshing take.
Yeah.
And it's literally just a straightforward take on the book. Would you recommend this movie?
I do really enjoy this movie. I do recommend watching it. And like I said before, I really love the sword fighting. I do think that this movie deserves to be in the list of top 100 movies with realistic sword fighting. I would actually probably say top 50, maybe top 20. I really enjoyed this movie for its realistic, spontaneous sword fighting. I also think people might just enjoy it for the swashbuckly adventure and the swarmy humor. Well, we hope that you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please subscribe. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review. If you want to follow us, you can follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema, on Twitter at TML A Journey. We are on Facebook at The Movie Log 1. You can also find all our past episodes on our website, tmlajourneythroughcinema.com. Join us next week for our first movie musical. Thanks for listening.